Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast to have worked with Professor Stein before he died, and then we stopped. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I was going to say I'm the faceless ones in a 3D sauna, but I'm really just stunned.
And I think we're all going to be stunned as we head into some wonderful CSO video model work in Nightmare of Eden.
It's Bob Baker solo after the great divorce.
That's a video I never ever want to see again.
Yeah, it's like 1979's worst album release ever. But it turns
Thank
out...
Thank you for cleaning that up.
Yeah. It does turn out that Dave Martin was to blame for everything.
I think. Bob Baker can actually write.
This is surprisingly good.
There was a lot of reworking on the studio floor. Lewis Fiander's brilliant interpretation of Al Brendan was one of them, and he threw that in, as you know, on the floor to lighten up the mood.
It's terrible. It's really, it is. He nearly wrecks
And yet
this.
Some of the best model effects shot in one of the worst manners you could possibly do that blew the budget. It has a nice, tight, and actually interesting script. It has some terrific... Hello, David Dacre. It has some terrific actors, guest artists, and we can thank Alan Bromley for the casting.
Yeah.
And we can also thank Alan Bromley for a lot of other things, can't we? Alan Bromley being, for the listener at home who's never bothered to watch this, and you don't need to if we're talking about it, the director.
That's right.
And he also directed one of my all-time favies.
The Time Warrior.
Mr. Potato Man meets medieval beak noses. Yes.
Which also featured David Dacre.
Yes.
Did Alan Bromley had the tendency to just kind of down tools and walk off the set?
Not exactly. Well, it's strange. He was sort of this contradiction in that he was a very old school director, and by this point he was
very old,
semi-retired. He was in his 60s.
We're talking Ali Pally era directing, yeah.
But at the same time, he was very dynamic in the sense that he was changing things after a week's rehearsal on the studio floor, and that was the main thing that caused tension between himself and the other actors, and particularly Tom.
It didn't make sense that an old TV director who cut his teeth in the early days of BBC and therefore knew that everything is immobile except the upper third of the actor's face, because that's all you can move. It's true. That's why Billy used to wave the hands, is because I can't move from my shot. Your mark is your mark. And we'll get to that a bit later, won't we, when a certain thing happened on the studio floor?
Indeed.
About marks? Mark, yes. Aha. But it makes no sense to me why he was at cross purposes with his own intentions. And you get that. Do you think that's why this story should be good and isn't good?
Well,
we've got to that already, haven't
we? The odd thing is, surprise, surprise, dear listener, I've always rather enjoyed this one. And when I was learning about the directorial problems, which you can see in the info text on the DVD, I was quite amazed, because I don't see that much wrong with the direction, as we sometimes get in the 1980s, where it's just a matter of, okay, Peter, Janet, Mark, you've got 1 minute to do this 3 minute scene, go, we'll cut as we go. I don't get that same sense here, but maybe that's down to the cast kind of going, we can't allow these problems behind the scenes to come across on screen. And I'm just going to go on record as saying I actually really like Trist's accent.
Oh, gosh, it's terrible. It's this sort of sub Peter Sellers thing that he's got going that
it's
he
deliberately
clearly
Peter
thinks
Sellers.
Is funny.
Yes.
But do you know why he did it?
Yeah, because they were all having such miserable time in rehearsal, because Bromley was really cantankerous and angry, and he shouldn't have been brought back. It was kind of a favour from Williams, wasn't it, to keep getting Williams.
So what,
he was
about
to retire.
So
Fiander was doing it to make the rest of the cast
laugh. Make everyone laugh, because Bromley was just being a monster. And yes, as you say, notes coming down from the control room constantly.
Yeah, you know, can you change this? But another reason Lewis Fiander did that accent, or what he said in later years, was that he read the script and found out, spoiler alert, dear listeners, he's one of the villains at the end. And he thought, you know what, if I make myself ridiculous, it will be a surprise to the viewer when I'm revealed as a villain.
Yeah, but But he, that's just really terrible. There's, I don't know whether we've mentioned this before, but Douglas Adams has this thing that he says about the problem with the way that actors respond to a script that's funny.
Yeah.
And he thinks comedy should be played straight, and that makes it more effective. In The Pirate Planet, for instance, there's all these jokes and things, and then we discover that this massive atrocity is happening and all of these worlds are being destroyed, and the jokes and the horror of that kind of work really well together.
It's a, and it's a very Adams way of writing, actually.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they held it over for the next season. But that you make jokes to increase the dichotomy and therefore the tension when it's released.
But what Adams always says is that when actors see that, then they come in and do funny voices and funny walks and that kind of thing and just undermine it completely. Ah, and I just think that Fiander's thing is the absolute canonical example of that. It's really, really a shame. And it just renders every scene that he's in sort of distractingly kind of ridiculous.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I'm very cross about it. Because I like you, I actually think that this is really good. And I think it displays some of the Baker and Martin problems, but it doesn't fall into the trap that they usually fall into. So I think the problem is the characters are all sort of rather broadly drawn and sort of fairly terrible. But the Baker and Martin problem of coming up with, you know, an idea and then abandoning it after 5 to 7 minutes only to run after a new shiny idea, which was really, really evident in, say, Armageddon Factor. Here I think there's three main ideas and they're all linked and they're all kind of involved in the plot and they all resolve themselves at more or less the same time.
Mm.
And I don't know whether that's just because Bob Baker's having a good day or whether it's the influence of Douglas Adams, because Douglas Adams is someone who plots things. You know, you kind of think of him as a fairly shambolic writer and you've got Hitchhikers, which is famous for being made up while the actors are in the other room, you know, waiting for their lines to appear.
Yeah,
but his books are really tightly plotted.
You can see the way the man's mind worked, and what it was over. And again, everyone gives Joss Whedon the credits for story arcing in The Medium, but it's actually Adams with Hitchhikers and now with Doctor Who. This whole season has a thread we touched on the last time, of the individual against order, if you like, against boredom, capitalism, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
It all dovetails beautifully. This one, again, is a really nicely arcing Adam's feel, and you can follow those threads you're talking about through how this flows. And there's a very dark and real, well, to not say dark, it's just truthful concept of how drugs are bad. they are. And it shows me how things fall apart. And the David Dacre character is the linchpin of that. And he plays it for real.
Yeah, it's
he doesn't.
Well, he does as much TV. Rule one of drugs on TV is everyone on TV has much better drugs than you. Because, like, no one ever behaves on drugs like they behave on drugs on television.
We haven't seen what Vrax, or Zip, as it was called. We haven't seen what Vraxine actually can do, though. And if you've seen, you know, television, Crystal Meth, it's actually over. Yeah, I think he underplays a high.
Well, that's the thing as well. You know, he plays what we would see someone as having been on very hard drugs for a very long time coming down. Well, we don't have time to do that in Doctor Who. So we have this space drug which gives you 15 million hits all at once, and then the resulting withdrawal. So
like the internet, really. Popularity on the internet.
So, you know, it's not necessarily a gritty, realistic portrayal of drugs, but it's as realistic a portrayal of drugs as Doctor Who can do. And that scene where he attacks Romana, it is harrowing, and both actors are playing it incredibly well. A few weeks ago, I criticised Lala's reaction to the Daleks as being a bit too scared, but I think Romana plays the fear in that scene very well. She's kind of doing the thing that we credit Elizabeth Sladen a lot for, you know, being scared and being brave at the same time, because she knows that she has to do this scientific gobbledygook thing. And that's her driving force in the scene, and this is her obstacle. But for once, you know, as we've come to expect, Romana just sort of brushing aside anything that's far too dull and uninteresting for her, she's like, no, I actually have to deal with this real-world thing that's happening. And it's quite interesting that Romana, with all her power as a Time Lord that she's demonstrated in all of her stories up until this point, she doesn't get herself out of that situation. And it's kind of sending the message that there are dangerous situations in the real world which you may get yourself into trouble to if you approach. You know, if she had, say, just karate chopped him in the neck, you could see that as irresponsible, because that's kind of saying to children, well, if someone's acting manic, you know, just karate chop them in the neck. Whereas actually, Romana's like, I'm trying to avoid this terrible situation, and gets rescued by Geoffrey Hinsliff as Fisk, who at one point calls Trist Fisk. And it is this kind of strange, very real danger in the middle of this story about polystyrene monsters who crumble and turn into an illicit substance.
So terrifying they couldn't be seen on the photo shoot. Do you remember
that's
all
right,
that?
Yes.
Before we go to that, we're talking about verisimilitude within performances, aren't we, within the narrative. And look, I'm sort of in the middle, literally, at this table as well, but thinking that, yeah, I can see where they're going with this, and certainly when I was young, thinking again, first time watching this, which was always the freshest interpretation, I got that too. But in the end, it was really about Quantel, mostly. That's actually what the drug shoot... And it was originally going to be called Zip, the episode, but Lala and Williams thought that that was actually making drugs too attractive.
It was too cool.
Yeah. I think this narrative, like you're saying, Brendan, really, really achieves its end far greater than Nancy Reagan ever could, because it makes drugs look not just utterly uncool, but kind of something you just don't really want to get involved with because it just looks a little bit messy. Mm-hmm. What did you think?
I think it's a strange place for Doctor Who to go, and it's something that it doesn't really do again. And I think it is a bit heavy-handed. And I'm not sure that element of the plot really works. I'm not quite sure who off-screen is drugging people's drinks and why. So
David, I always assumed it was Trist.
Yeah, so David Dacre gets a dose intended for Romana.
Yes.
And the co-pilot or the navigator in episode one, he's being drugged, so they cause the crash.
Right? He hasn't been drugged. He is taking the drug. Like, yes. He has his own supply.
Oh, okay.
Which he possibly got from Trist. It's never confirmed one way or the other.
Yeah, see, there is some slackness to that part
and
of the
plot. And we shouldn't be having to sit here and puzzle that out. Yeah. That stuff should be obvious. I mean, it's not as entertaining as finding out Felicity Kendall's, you know, entomological love child is actually the one slipping them everything, don't you think? It's not really about that. It's not the unicorn and the wasp. It's just, that was fun. If you're looking for a mystery thing going on, okay, what was the drug in that tea?
Well, I want to know why it's called Vraxoan instead of Vraxoan as well, because clearly it's like space heroin, isn't it?
So, well, it was Zip.
Yeah, I know, but so they call it Vraxoan. There is a reference to Zip, like XYP is the fungus that it comes from. Mm-hmm. That was how it was sort of going to be referred to.
I just realised that means the mandrills are fungal creatures.
They are. That's because why they have those huge moustaches. I actually thought it was a statement, a really prescient statement on the drug culture coming up in the 80s, because they all look like Freddie Mercury plush toys.
Mm. I actually think it's just really damp on Eden and they're not very careful with their personal hygiene. That would be...
Well, they were originally scripted as mud monsters.
Yeah.
You know, and then that was changed.
What do you think of them? I think they're terribly cute.
They are very
cute. You do want to hug them, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, they're terribly sweet.
Which is good in a way, because they're not evil.
No.
You know, they're
just beasts.
They're just
aren't
beasts.
They?
I think a big problem
like
with
many mustachioed tall things were in the late 70s.
Including bell bottoms.
Including,
yes.
Yeah, most of the crew on this ship.
There is that flavour. Yeah. Was it? But Alan Bromley has no hint of being theatrically minded in other ways.
I think that's just the look at the time. I think a big problem with the mandrills is in episodes 2 and 3, when we're wondering about the Eden projection or we see them in the matter interfaces, we get the Terrence Dix, Robert Holmes approach of, you know, we see a claw or we see a close-up of an eye or we see this or we see that. It's rather undermined by the fact that at the end of episode 1, we see one leaning through a hole going, grawr!
Waving its arms.
Yes.
In fact, that's a terrible episode 1 monster
through
reveal.
Through the round window. No, yeah, exactly.
No, because they cut the hole in the thing for no readily apparent reason. It comes out and roars. Then next week we have the reprise and they go, oh, we'll seal that hole up again. And so they just seal it up immediately.
Exactly. And I don't think we've seen them before. You know, we've heard them growl before, but we haven't had the whole bit by bit by bit by bit like you do in, say, Terror of the Zygons. It's just, and a monster came!
Well, I think they're sweet. I love it when the Doctor uses his little sonic whistle and they do little groaning, sweet groaning noises. He pied pipes them, yeah.
And there's lots of underplays. Some of the best lines were cut out, probably as they will be from most of our podcasts, gentle listener. You know, when Romana's chomping on an apple in that scene, you know, and Tom looks at her and says, best not to look what happened last time. After that line, that's probably why they cut it out. Don't you find that Della and Stott, who is what, Jennifer Lonsdale and a bloke.
Barry Andrews.
We're actually pretty good. I just thought they were the best. Yeah. The best. This is the problem. You're pitching for realism, and then you're kind of pitching for Panto, Doctor Who, Quantil.
Yeah, and you've got them in the same frame, though.
Yeah, it's going to end. It's always going to end up the same squeaking sound that deck chairs on the Titanic make, don't you?
So, can we talk about the Quantel paint box thing?
Please, terribly exciting.
I actually think that it's some of the most successful bits in the episode. Like the opening scene with those models. I think the models look quite good.
They
were
beautiful, and they cost a lot.
It looks like gold. Do you remember the Blake 7 episode Gold, which has sort of similar sort of model work?
Yeah. Wonderful. Is that your pick of the
pick of the week? Yeah. And, like, the video effects are really great, and then the unstable matter interfaces look really good.
Yeah, it's lovely.
There's that fantastic cliffhanger to episode 3.
Yeah, that's when they walk through the...
When Tom gets dissolved.
Yeah, when he disappears.
That's another question. Yeah.
Really great.
Yeah, it's those two big things. We look at that now and go, oh, yeah, that's you know, it's nicely done. But that was a massive wow back in the day. We hadn't seen it, and it took them forever to shoot that. So kudos, I guess, to Bromley. For getting that right.
Well, particularly the aversion that he showed to proper effects of any kind in the previous time.
Yes, indeed.
I think there was a whole lot. Well, you know that some of this direction we're praising was actually Graham Williams when he came down onto the studio floor.
Yes, indeed. Just another word on that Quantel. It's kind of what goes around comes around because the Quantel machine they were using was designed for picture-in-picture and news broadcasts.
Amy Stewart. It was designed for Amy Stewart wearing a carnival pretzel and singing Knock on Wood. Which came out just a few months before from Berlin.
But how they achieved the effects we see in Nightmare of Eden is similar to how Bernard Lodge achieved the first three Doctor Who title sequences. They fed the input back in on the machine and it then degraded and degraded and degraded, as with the Hartnell, Troughton, Pertwee opening title sequence.
I thought you were going to say as the quality of the narrative. Also, Bernard Lodge is not actually a person, it's a place. It's just a drug-fueled ghetto where Delia Derbyshire would sit and chew away on bits of piano wire, and that's why her teeth were so awful. And all those other young people just get up there, and that's what this story is about. This story is about young creatives getting into Bernard Lodge and ruining their future careers.
By taking Zip.
By chewing on a Zip, that's right.
Speaking of which, the mandrels, I think the Zip is actually named after that extraordinary feature on the back of the mandrel costume, which is constantly visible.
Thank you for raising that. There's a bit of a theme of hilariously and non-metaphorically splitting your trousers this season, isn't there? As we get it in this one as well. There's a whole lot of... what's Mr. Adams trying to tell us? What's Doug Adams trying to tell us about about bum flashing in this season?
I think he's for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, generally.
I wonder if it's a subtle comment on state of play, the BBC generally.
Well, in just 2 years' time, of course, he will flash his own bum in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Isn't bad, actually.
Yeah, you know.
He was this big chap. He had been a bouncer. He had been terribly fit before the fun of the 70s got to him. He never stopped having fun, and that's why we had him for such little time.
Mm. It is great sadness, isn't it?
Well, a great deal of alcohol and cigarettes. Yeah, but as we say, fun.
Combined with just a chronic inability to get anything finished, it just means that all we have are the 5 Hitchhiker's novels and 2.5 Dirk Gently, well, 2.25, 2.8 novels.
And you're right. But, you know, on paper, you're right. But I actually think he got more finished than we generally give credit. And you can see it in the way this season unfolds. And the fact that the last episode's last story's invisible is very Douglas Adams in itself, isn't it? Douglas Adams did actually have an overarching set of themes. And I'm not saying it was conscious, and I'm certainly not saying it was even worked out. What I am saying is he's so clever that unconsciously, if you like, he's spinning this out. And it does come together because truly, truly clever creative people are doing this on many levels at once. And I think that's, in the end, why we love him. He's giving us more that we can, even coming back 30-something years later, we can still find these new threads, these new surprises.
you know who in the modern era reminds me a bit of Douglas, and certainly not in terms of the content he produces?
Yes.
Quentin Tarantino. Because Quentin Tarantino has really quite a small oeuvre.
Repertoire, yes.
And, you know, he does have his constant themes, and I'm not saying I'm necessarily a fan of all his work, but like Douglas, he has his own vision and he sticks to that vision.
This is where it could get violent.
Yes, it did.
Speaking of Tarantino, I find Tarantino monstrously violent, and he is Asperger, and he's pretty much admitted, his mother talked about it, that he would just sit and stare at films and write them down. He just refilms other films. But I find his violence indigestible, and that's exactly what Douglas is against. So I know thematically, when you're talking about Threads, I see what you're saying, but it's an interesting person to bring up because they are diametrically opposed.
Absolutely. Yeah, I am
it's
not...
It's like saying the Black Guardian's a little more fun. Well, actually, the Black Guardian is probably more fun than the White Guardian. That's often the case.
Can we talk about the CET machine?
Bling!
What an interesting idea.
Bling. So, oh, yes, I love going to Space 1979 land.
Yes. So I think... Look, it's the Miniscope's non-Mexican Union equivalent, isn't it? Like, it was a great idea back when Bob Holmes had it in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
But I think that there are moments where it threatens to derail it as well. I think it's really incompetently done. And I think there are scenes that would have been just spectacular, like the cliffhanger to episode 2, had it been well realised. So the CET machine is basically, you know, like a bit of a picture frame surrounding half of the studio, and as Richard points out, it's just they drop in sort of film insets of planets from Space 1999.
They're all from Space 1999.
Yes.
Except for Eden, which is just
crap.
Like really shockingly bad, and not for a second does it look like a screen, and there's no sort of video effects over it, and so it's absolutely no surprise at all when they leap over that tiny bit of wall and end up in Eden. And it's quite a well acted cliffhanger. You've got Romana going, "We'll be torn apart," doing like more acting in one line than Mary did in an entire year.
Cool, but fair.
And all of that, you know, like the sting comes in before we cut to the credits, all of that sort of thing. It's really, really good.
Yeah.
But it just never convinces for a second. And there's that other scene, and I was mystified by this for years. She's standing in front of the projection. She's idly playing with the machine. She stands in front of the Eden projection, and a little video blip thing comes out and hits her on the neck, and she falls down. And I had no idea what that was meant to be until I read the novelization. It's an insect flying out of the projection.
Yeah, and it's meant to inform the audience that things can get out.
But it's incomprehensible.
Yeah, exactly. And even Bob Baker on the DVD says, you know, that's what I wrote into the script, and they had to make it into a video effect. And I understand why they did that, but you lose the meaning. The other thing with that cliffhanger, in the script, when they jump across the threshold, they don't just land in Eden. They are torn apart. And that is the cliffhanger, that they vanish the way Tom vanishes at the end of episode 3.
Oh, that would have been good.
And then at the top of episode 3, they just reappear in Eden. And the sort of falling action of the tension is that... Yeah. That's just how you get into the projection. You know, it dissolves you like a transporter, but we, the viewer, don't know that.
Yeah.
I still like the idea that if it had been a convincing screen, if we'd thought for a second it was a screen, having the Doctor and Romana jump into a television screen and end up on television would have been just terrific. Yeah.
You know what I think would have been a wonderful way to do it? Would be at some point to have filmed that screen from the side, and so when they jump in, you don't see them come out the other side. So it's the ultimate flat screen. The original idea was, you know, they would disappear in a maelstrom and you'd hear them screaming and that would be the cliffhanger. And unfortunately, you know, we would have just had Tom saying, "Oh, my arms, my legs, my everything. Oh!"
I quite like that.
So do I, but it's utterly stupid.
It is sort of preempted by the fact that he's wearing a different jacket this episode, and it's his stunt being torn apart on Eden jacket so that he still has the nice jacket for subsequent stories. Romana's costume, on the other hand,
is dreadful.
The most horrific thing she ever wears.
Well,
it's like a maternity frock.
Well, it is a maternity
frock. Once again,
frock.
I am a child of the 70s, and I have to say she's right up to the thumping minute in fashionability there. No, I actually think it's rather lovely. It's look at Carly Simon's album covers around the time. Look at... Mm.
I will say it looks wonderful when she's running, because of course in Doctor Who,
sort of floaty.
Yeah, in Doctor Who, for running you have to run very slowly, so the dress gives an indication of extra movement. You know,
I've come to regard Lala as, if you could say, symbiotically associated with her frock.
Yeah, no,
and there's the hair does some slightly odd things in Creature, but that was her first crack, wasn't it?
Yes,
Creature
yeah.
The Pit's doing a little bit sort of, I am going to play Ophelia, you know. I am.
So again?
We know you are. No, she hadn't done it. I thought she did it towards the end here. No, maybe you're right, because by the time we get to Nymon, she was certainly in charge of the BBC and dressing for the case. But in this one, I just look, all the frocks are lovely. I think what hurts this is the same reason that hurts a trip to Europe for Australians when you go anywhere further than the UK, or anywhere north, I should say, where if you go to any of the clean countries, the Scandinavians or the Dutch, and you go to any H&M sale or just anything really, you find everybody's wearing mustard. Mustard seems to be... I mean, it's not even really, it's just a way to cover up food you don't want to eat in the first place. And why did they paint this rather beautiful spaceship mustard?
Well,
I've got 4 episodes of looking at baby poo coloured walls. It does hurt.
It's apparently the Art Deco influence, and I believe the colour is called Colonial Cream.
It's very nice of them. There was a colour they called Tobacco, which I can pull out for you all listeners at home. You'll love that one. I show you pictures on the interweb and radio, I mean. But it's flat. And Lewis Fiander's just a naughty, naughty man for doing the accent.
It would have been nicer to have some sort of relief on the walls, you know, even just have
light relief.
Yes,
really.
Some light relief. Right,
yes.
But my old theatre group, there was a time when the director...
Alan Bromley.
Had two colours he would want painted into every set. Because, you know, we were doing shows like Are You Being Served and classic comedies like that, and they were Heritage Red and Colonial Cream. Everything was Heritage Red and Colonial Cream. We did a Doctor Who send-up. The Daleks were Heritage Red and Colonial Cream. I hope you're listening.
Did he force some mid-Brunswick green and Mission Brown?
Yeah, did he force you to go off to the London Zoo quite often? Because they are the colours of a baboon's bottom.
That's why they're called mandrels.
That's right. And we're back in the room.
So I'd like to talk a bit, if I may, about the directorial problems.
Oh, I think we're well beyond not talking about that.
So, as we know, there was no film work conducted for this, much to the chagrin of Colin Mapson, the model designer.
Yes.
Because he did design those ship models to be seen on film, and then they were shot on video. And he said, you know, usually we had 5 days to shoot on film, but there was a budget cut and we had 4 hours.
You get a lot of grain, we should say, with video that you don't get in those days with film. You can really up the quality and film very slowly on celluloid, so you get detail on a model.
Exactly.
Thank you, Ian Skoons, and the lovely opening to Invasion of Tinia, or whatever it's called, Invasion of Time.
But
I actually don't think they look that terrible.
You know, they're not terrible, but studio cameras were not designed to move in that way, because much like model work, a lot of model work for spaceships is still done now. The cameras were moving, not the models.
Not the models.
Which is why we get some very jittery model scenes.
The models.
And Richard is now moving a model.
That's right.
His home-built TARDISon he made when he was 12?
32 years old.
32 years.
Just as now, old as the listener, as long as the listener's been listening to this podcast, I imagine they're feeling.
Now,
let's get to Alan Bromley, because we love the monsters, don't we?
The reason that the budget was slashed so much is Graham Williams said, I will not produce a season finale on a shoestring again. I'll take some money earlier in the year when inflation means that money is made, that money goes further.
Yeah, because inflation was really ripping away, wasn't
exactly.
It?
Yeah. So
no, that makes no sense. If you're saving money that's worth more now and inflation's rising, later it'll be worth less.
Yes, but he has more of it to play. I know, it doesn't make any sense, does it? If he could only sort of jump forward in time and use that money and then bring it back to now.
Bring that money back.
The cost of your meal is incredibly paid for. So we have 6 studio days.
That was perfect.
We have 6 studio days to cover these 4 episodes. And as we discussed earlier, Bromley constantly changing things, not communicating well with the cast, wasn't going down well.
Do we know why he was such a cranky back bottom on this?
No, we really don't.
Anyone?
There's no sort of indication.
Well, we know what happened and why. He ticked Lala off. The thing was she wasn't on her mark, which he'd only just moved and she didn't know about. And he really tore strips off her from the booth.
According to, I think it's the makeup designer, Joan Stribling, gave an interview where she said it was a full-blown verbal assault, which lasted minutes in front of the entire cast and crew. Yeah. And that was actually the final straw for Tom.
Then spent the day muttering
not under
so
his
sotto
breath.
Voce, but in fact, so the control room could hear about, you know, what an ass.
I'm going to get, I think it's Citicata from that chap up there, being a disease that you get from parrots.
Yes.
Because, as he also commented, do we have a director up there or in commentator?
Wow.
Tom at his worst best.
And the thing is, that is what he actually screamed into the microphone. And production broke for dinner. And everyone went off for dinner. And came back to do the last half day's filming. And Graham Williams was in the gallery saying, right, I'm calling the shots now. And
how much lighter and fresher?
So Bromley was replaced.
Oh, yeah.
And there is no consensus on whether Graham Williams fired him or Graham Williams pulled him to one side and said, Alan, do you think maybe you should go home? And some people say that Alan said, you're right, I've had enough of this, I've wanted to say this for weeks. But, yeah, I think it speaks a lot to Tom's professionalism that he was willing
to... Wait, phrases you rarely hear.
hear me out. That as disenchanted as he was and disenfranchised by Alan Bromley's working method, it was only when Bromley did the ultimate professional sin of personally attacking not just a cast member, but at this stage, Tom's partner, really. I believe they were dating at this stage. But I would like to think if he'd done it to any cast member, Tom would have probably done the same thing. You know,
Tom, not as much. But
Tom, you know, put up with a lot until the director had lost control, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And considering that Tom has put up with Norman Stewart on Underworld, not that Norman Stewart was necessarily a problem, but Norman Stewart was a technical director, he didn't know how to direct actors, but Tom was sympathetic to that, you know. Tom could only take so much before he just said, look, enough is enough, I need to take care of this as the star of the show. And we hear so much this year about, oh, Tom's out of control, this, that, the other. I think if Tom was out of control, he probably would have attacked Bromley far sooner. But
Bromley was a way up in the control room.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, they did actually have a screaming match before this, but both of them said that actually cleared the air, you know, and they were able to work well for a day or so after that. Speaking of directorial commands coming from on high, we've got an obelisk coming in, gentlemen.
So here we are with The Nightmare of Eden, listeners. You know, I maintain that Bob Baker and Dave Martin write two good episodes of Doctor Who a year, but this is just Bob Baker by himself. And you know what? I actually really like this script, but I don't think it should have ever been attempted in 1979 or even 1989. I actually think that it could have been rewritten for the new series as a 45-minute episode and produced with great special effects for the new series. What do you think? Anyway, I'm now off to the next story. Surely the monsters can't get any sillier.
It's a good point.
I hate drug things on television, drug message stories on television. I think that I think it's just disingenuous to say that there's a problem with drugs separate from the problem caused by the way we treat them in the criminal justice system.
Actually,
so
that's exactly
stories
right.
about how drugs are bad just annoy the hell out of me. And I also think that they tend to be directed against young people. They tend to be middle-aged people writing about how terrible young people are. So
it's you young people and the fun what you want.
I don't want Nancy Reagan to waltz on set and start lecturing me in Doctor Who, frankly. And so
and Capaldi have similar hair.
They do. Increasingly so. So I don't like the drug thing at all. I do like the unstable matter interfaces thing, you know, creating weird spaces.
Kids don't muck around with unstable
That's
matter
right.
interfaces.
That's right, exactly. Yes. Don't get started with them. They'll ruin your life. And the fact that the spaces created are weird television spaces, you know, that consist of video effects and stuff. I think all of that stuff is great. You know, there's a lot of good things to say about this, but the drug thing just annoys the hell out of me.
If I'd had my time over, I would have talked about the era of prohibition in the US and how it was one man trying to protect his anti-alcohol department and the Oh, the levels of corruption, as you know, and the increase in crime. And he just didn't want to lose, and Hoover was with him, of course, but he didn't want to lose his money in his department, so they just transferred their interest from alcohol to drugs. It's really where it's all come from.
Mm. And of
course, it was readily available. My grandmother used to buy heroin in distilled, which you could buy at the pharmacist.
Mm. Drugs don't start to become
illegal. For ladies' pains, yeah. Yes.
Drugs don't start to become illegal in Australia until 1905, I think, and then it's a racist thing directed against the Chinese, banning opium for smoking. But you could still
that would have been a more fun episode, actually.
Well, you could still get opium for drinking at the chemist, you know,
in Newtown right now.
Yeah.
And of course, in America around the time of the Great Depression, the actual reason that marijuana was banned, it was nothing to do with reefer madness. It was everything to do with the cotton industry.
Yes, of course, because hemp is a much better, far lower a water-using product and much stronger. But of course, the industry is already there. Why do you think Americans still have pennies? Because of the zinc lobby. It costs more to make a penny than it does to mint one. But of course...
Well, it now costs more to make a 5-cent piece than to mint one.
Yeah.
So we may see the back of those.
Does it cost more? 5-cent pieces. Can I just say how much I hate them? And if I ever have, like, 2 5-cent pieces, I'm really, really anxious and angry until I can get rid of at least one of them.
That's why we have Boy Scouts. Mm. Just insert them in a Boy Scout.
Oh, okay, all right.
I wonder if really it's the same with Nightmare of Eden, and that it costs more to watch this than it did to produce.
Yes, I think that's almost certainly true. This podcast had a higher budget, yeah, I think, probably. Yeah.
Can I draw attention to one performance that I think is truly dire?
Really? Just the one?
You know what? Just one. Because as I've said, I don't have a problem with Louis Fiander. I think Jeffrey Hinsliv is awful in this.
Who's he?
He's Fisk.
Yeah, he's shockingly bad, isn't he?
Which is amazing, because he's so good in Image of the Fendal.
Yeah, he's lovely in that.
Peter Kreis is okay, you know.
Which one's Peter Kreis?
Peter Kreis is Darko, and he's also Michael Kreis's brother.
Yeah.
So Peter Kreis is the other customs officer.
Everyone was having a rotten time during the shoot, and actors, sensitive actors, and Hinsliv is one of them, can't do their best if they don't feel loved. Just as we feel loved by you, dear listener, and why we're still here doing this, because we love you. And not 5-cent pieces.
No. I want to find some way of shoehorning a reference to Dimon's evil villain to-do list. Because I love a good evil villain to-do list.
Just cut all of my silliness out and just put that in.
We haven't had an evil villain to-do list since Peter Butterworth, really. Do you remember that? And it's very prescient, because I think the next story we do owes, in a timey-wimey kind of reverse causality sort of way, owes a lot to Marge versus the Monorail. And Lyle Lanley has a very, very fantastic illustrated evil to-do list as well. So I like to encourage people to keep to-do lists. I think it's an important productivity thing, and if you're a villain, I think it's particularly important to keep track of your next actions and your long-term projects.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. I let it go. That's why I'm not the villain I should have been. There you go, kids. Just don't do lists.
Dear listeners, we're departing the orbit of the planet Azure to put the residents of the planet Vridge back where they belong. Until next week, when we'll be back with the Horns of Nymon, please check us out online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. We also have, finally, Bondfinger is up to date with Casino Royale and the first 5 Sean Connery Bond films. Casino Royale, of course, being 1967. You can find that on bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and Bondfingercast on Twitter. Until next week, may you never feel comfortable in an electronic zoo. Thank you very much and good night.
Good night.
Good then.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brenda Jones, and Richard Stone. This episode, I Don't Want Nancy Reagan, was recorded on the 6th of February. The next episode will be released on February 21st. I hope that this accent has concealed that I am actually the villain of the... Damn!
The Nightmare of Eden, February the 6th.
I think it's just Nightmare of Eden.
Yes, that's right. There's no definite article.
It's of a Mars. Bare role nominal.
There you go, kids. Just don't do lists. Don't transcribe every other composer for piano. Don't do list. How funny was that?
That's terrible.
Apologies to Leslie Howard. How funny was that?
So okay. You keep Chopin changing that line every time you deliver.
Your bark's worse than your bite.